everyone. Welcome to Selected Essays, a podcast series from The Point magazine about essays you should read but probably haven't. Each episode, we'll be talking with writers about an essay that's influenced one of their own. My name is Jess Swoboda, and I'm here with my co-host, Zach Fine.
Hey, everyone. This week, we spoke with Jennifer Wilson about Victor Shklovsky's Art as Device and Jennifer's essay, The Love Letters That Spoke of Everything But Love, about Shklovsky's epistolary novel, Zoo. Jennifer is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Previously, she was contributing essayist at the New York Times Book Review. She holds a PhD in Russian literature from Princeton University.
We hope you'll enjoy this episode and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you have questions, comments, or anything else, send an email to selectedessays@thepointmag.com. We'd love to hear from you. And also be sure to subscribe to The Point, the magazine that brings you content like this podcast. You can find a 50% off discount code exclusive to listeners in the episode notes.
Hey, Jen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about Victor Shklovsky?
I can do my best. He lived a very long time. He lived to be 91 years old, which is a lot of life for someone, for, you know, Russian of the 20th century. I guess I can talk more about his early life, kind of, you know, around the time that he wrote the essay that we're discussing today, Art as Device. He was sort of a leader of what has now been kind of labeled kind of after the fact as Russian formalism. I don't think a lot of people realize the Russian formalists didn't call themselves that. It was sort of, you know, kind of an insult that was levied at them by their critics. You know, they didn't think of themselves that way. They didn't sort of think of what they were doing as this way of approaching literature that was, you know, like apolitical or something. But basically, you know, he was kind of part of this group of writers and critics who were interested in developing kind of a scientific approach to the study of literature and literary criticism. You know, Shklovsky was a leftist. He was not a Bolshevik, but he was a leftist. You know, so he was interested kind of in just kind of like revolutionary, you know, kind of like rhetoric and, you know, this kind of idea of like art and artists have use and utility and everyone has to sort of be doing something and bringing about kind of a new reality, a new sensibility. He was one of the founders of this group in St. Petersburg called Obayaz, the translation is Society for the Study of Poetic Language. Their kind of counterpart in Moscow was the Moscow Linguistic Circle run by Roman Jakobson. So that's sort of who he was. And in 1917, he wrote the essay we're discussing today, Art as Device. And it's considered kind of the manifesto of this, again, I hate to use the word Russian formalism, term Russian formalism, but it's fine. But he was sort of, this is kind of the manifesto for this, new kind of movement of young critics who were trying to think scientifically about what art and what literature is and what it does, what it can do for a world that is, you know, in the process of remaking itself.
And can you say a bit about why you selected this essay, Art as Device?
Yeah, I just remember, you know, I read it in graduate school, and I just remember being so excited by its just kind of the attitude that it has. You know, I think when I was in graduate school and academia, everything is so sort of polite and everyone's so kind of like, you know, well, you know, kind of, you know, well-mannered and genteel. I mean, obviously it's like sort of masking like ferocious competitiveness and all this stuff, but like, you know, it was really exciting to read a work of literary criticism that was just so kind of like pugnacious and that was just so that just took itself, you know, very seriously and considered the study of literature something worth fighting for. I really loved the energy of it, just stylistically. And I think it gave me kind of a new set of questions to bring to literature that I hadn't, you know, I hadn't really thought to ask before. I mean, I think how is such a big question that this essay asks, is how does literature do the things that it does? And I never really thought to ask that. You know, I always just sort of, so I was trying to figure out, like, what is art doing, or, you know, what's it about, or, you know, why did it come into the world? But I think, again, like, sort of, I never really thought that I could kind of break literature apart in the way that this essay doesn't even just suggest, but sort of, you know, commands you to.
Yeah, why don't we turn to the essay now? Can you read the first passage for us?
"Art is thinking in images." That's a quote, unquote. "Poetry is a special way of thinking. It is precisely a way of thinking in images, a way which permits what is generally called economy of mental effort, a way which makes for, quote, sensation of the relative ease of the process, unquote. Quote, without imagery, there is no art. Art is thinking in images, unquote. These maxims have led to far-fetched interpretations of individual works of art. Attempts have been made to evaluate even music, architecture, and lyric poetry as imagistic thought." So these are a bunch of, part of my hesitation was that we're supposed to read these, perceive all of these quotes as just kind of like idiocy. He's basically just quoting a bunch of critics he doesn't like, and sort of trying to, you know, so he kind of lists off these kinds of, you know, things that are frequently said about art. You know, art is thinking in images, you know, mainly the idea that the task of art is to take, you know, these extremely complex, you know, metaphysical abstract concepts and sort of bring them down to earth in these concrete images. The idea that that's sort of the task of art is to ease the process of comprehension in some way, or perception in some way. That's what he's kind of mocking here. So he's basically just listing a bunch of quotes from other critics that he thinks are just completely worthless, which is sort of kind of like what I was saying about, you know, Shklovsky was difficult. He was sort of this person, he would kind of ruin parties, ruin meetings. He was kind of a risky person to have around. I know we're going to talk about Zhu later, but when he was living in Berlin, he was asked to be part of this new literary journal, emigre journal there. And it's like, you know, Shklovsky, you got to have him there. You know, he's a major figure, but, you know, someone comes to give a talk at this thing, and Shklovsky just rips the guy to shreds. And it's just like this absolute nightmare. Like, and, you know, Gorky's like, what are you doing? We're trying to get more people to be on our board. We can't be tearing people apart like this. And Shklovsky's like, I'm sorry. I'm in love. You know, he was like in love with this woman. He was just in a bad mood that day. So he's just, you know, he's a difficult kind of character, and you kind of get that right away in this essay, which is another thing I really just like about this essay too, is like, it feels like he and only he could write this.
It's almost 1,000 words into the essay before we get to that famous passage where he talks about defamiliarization. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could walk us through the argument that he's making on those first two pages about why he sets up his argument about defamiliarization in terms of a contrast between practical language and poetic language, prose and poetry.
I can do my best. It's a difficult, you know, this is very, Russian formalist high theory of, you know, over 100 years ago. It's a bit kind of, you know, it's a kind of a style of argumentation that's a little to us now arcane. But, you know, I think that he basically what he's trying to sort of build up is this idea that sort of language can sort of serve two functions. It can just sort of be there's sort of like this kind of like everyday kind of prosaic language. And he kind of compares it to like, he's like, you know, if you do something every day, you start to forget if you've done it already. And I was, you know, I was sort of, when I was reading this, I was thinking about how, I don't know if any of you, if you take like vitamins or pills mm-hmm. or something, but you know, you have that thing where you're like, oh, did I take that or not? Mm-hmm. He's sort of saying, well, that's exactly how language works. Like if it becomes habitual, then it's almost like it ceases to exist because it doesn't force you to stop. It becomes automatic. And so he's sort of saying that's prosaic language. And then there's poetic language that sort of forces you to sort of stop and to pay attention and to notice. And that's where he gets into the famous line about like the task of art is to make the stone stony. You know, I think like one of my favorite parts was when he talks about habitualization, you know, he's like, once things become habitual, you know, it devours work, clothes, furniture, one's wife, and the fear of war. So it's I know it's sort of like a long build up to his argument. You know, I think again, it's also about sort of this whole notion of a scientific approach to literature and literary criticism. I think he's almost sort of like laying everything out in the sort of way that you might lay out a math problem. So it's a bit, yeah, I understand it's a bit kind of a challenging to get through, but it's almost supposed to, you know, in some ways he's sort of, he's doing kind of the stony stone of literary criticism and, you know, he's sort of making it feel unusual, making it feel like something a little different. It's, you know, it's a little bit more scientific. It's a little bit more analytical. It's, you know, it's kind of, yeah, defamiliarized literary criticism.
So he's really known for defamiliarization. Can you tell us what he means by that and why he sees it as so important?
Yes. So it's a great term because it means exactly what it sounds like. Some people translate it defamiliarization. The other way you might translate it is making strange, making something strange. Mm-hmm. Basically, he saw defamiliarization as a way of destroying the kind of automatization of perception. For instance, when he talks about Tolstoy and the way Tolstoy writes about war, and he's like, well, Tolstoy writes about war as if no one has ever seen a war before. That sort of, defamiliarization or that sort of scene with kind of like the theater. And it's just kind of like, it's very confusing. You just sort of see the initial description is just kind of like, you know, body parts flying and wooden floorboards, and you don't exactly know what you're seeing. And then all it sort of kind of puts together, you understand it's kind of a stage. That's sort of what he means by defamiliarization, something that kind of forces you to spend a lot of time with words, with language, with literature, figuring out what it means. He really believed that perception should be prolonged. Whereas he felt that bad art is art that is too everyday. It just kind of makes everything feel ordinary, habitual, things you just kind of consume very quickly without thinking. You know, for him, kind of great art sort of forced you to stop and experience the world anew every time.
Yeah, in this section on the unfamiliar, on defamiliarization, he has this line, art is a way of experiencing the artfulness of an object. The object is not important. And this made me stop for a minute. Like, what does this mean? And so what does he mean when he says the object is not important? Are we supposed to take this literally? Or is it really only the aesthetic quality of the object that matters to him?
I think that what he is saying is that he's much more interested in perception rather than what is being perceived. You know, I think that's sort of his focus in this essay, which I feel like we should mention is quite short. It's provocative. You know, he'll like, you know, in some ways, I think kind of later revise a lot of this. But yeah, I mean, I think is that his fear was that we sort of get caught up too much in the object rather than the way that art introduces us to a particular object. And he wanted people to be aware of the ways that art kind of could rewire your sensibility. Again, it's about sort of pushing back against the automation of perception, just kind of, so that's what he means. I don't think that he sort of is suggesting that what's being represented is irrelevant. I just don't think that that's, he's making a provocative argument.
Right.
So it's not going to hold up. And I think one of the things I really like towards the very end of this essay is he says, he's kind of like mocking the entire project of formalism, period. You know, he's talking about rhythm and trying to come up with a kind of a grand unified theory of rhythm. He's like, there is order in art, yet not a single column of Greek temple stands exactly in its proper order. He's like, to a certain extent, if you turn something into too much of a science, you're also kind of destroying what makes it art. So there's this kind of like, I don't think that you're wrong to pick up on certain kind of like flaws in his argument, but I think on some level he's okay with a flawed provocative argument.
Right. And phrasing it, the object does not matter, is a provocative way of phrasing that statement. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's a really helpful way of kind of viewing it. So why don't we turn to the passage about Tolstoy's work that you selected as a way to keep talking about this idea of defamiliarization and kind of what Tolstoy is doing in this essay.
Tolstoy makes the familiar seem strange by not naming the familiar object. He describes an object as if he were seeing it for the first time, an event as if it were happening for the first time. In describing something, he avoids the accepted names of its parts and instead names corresponding parts of other objects. For example, in Shame, Tolstoy defamiliarizes the idea of flogging in this way. Quote, to strip people who have broken the law, to hurl them to the floor, to rap on their bottoms with switches, to lash about on the naked buttocks. Then he remarks, just why precisely this stupid, savage means of causing pain and not any other? Why not prick the shoulders or any part of the body with needles, squeeze the hands or the feet in a vice or anything like that? I apologize for this harsh example, but it is typical of Tolstoy's way of pricking the conscience. The familiar act of flogging is made unfamiliar both by the description and by the proposal to change its form without changing its nature.
That's a great passage. When you chose that, it wasn't the first passage that I expected necessarily. So why did you choose this passage in particular?
I think that it's a really great illustration of his point. And, you know, it's one of those things, like I remember reading this essay and kind of, you know, not really necessarily thinking about it again. And then once I started reading more of Tolstoy, I thought, oh gosh, like no, it's absolutely true. The way that he pulls you into a world in a way that is so unexpected. Like I was just running this reading group for Anna Karenina, and I completely forgot there are like these long passages that are in the voice of Levin's dog. And it's such this interesting vantage point to think about, you know, Levin as like this landowner, and there's this, you know, dog that's just like, I don't know how to make him happy. I don't know how to give him what he wants. And yet that feels like the entire point of my life is to give this person what he wants. And, and you realize that on some level, like this is kind of the condition of a lot of the peasants. And yet there's something about getting this kind of, you know, getting it from this dog that just kind of reminds you of just like how impossible it is to sort of like anticipate the desires of people in charge, even though that's exactly what your job is to a certain extent. And, so I just really felt like, this does a really great job of sort of how kind of Tolstoy takes you out of a scene. Even as he describes scenes, like, quite beautifully, sometimes you always kind of
it forces you to kind of stop and consider not just what you're reading, but other things, other really important things. And yeah, I do think that Tolstoy is a writer of tremendous conscience.
Shklovsky's argument, even when it's not really explicitly cited, has become so important to the defense of art and literature today, I feel like, in terms of arguments about art as a way of making things difficult, art as a way of making things slow, lengthening perception, you know, in terms of like resisting the attention economy and things like this. And I'm kind of wondering if you think the reason Shklovsky's had this long afterlife is part of his kind of resonance with that today, or if there's something that's changed in the kind of cultural climate from Shklovsky's own time that, draws some kind of contrast.
I mean, do you feel like people are reading Shklovsky still? Because I don't know. I think they should. I think for precisely, and this is another one of the reasons why I think I suggested this, is like I have been thinking a lot about, attention, art kind of being, automized, and I think that he has a lot to say to the present moment, but I haven't had a sense that there's been that much interest in him outside of like my really kind of small academic world. I've been a really big proponent for a lot of his translations have been kind of like out of print for a while. I've been like a really big proponent for Zoo, Letters Not About Love, his epistolary novel set in Berlin, which I was really excited to hear that Dalkey Archive and Deep Vellum are finally reissuing. And I believe believe you can pre-order it now, actually, but that's been like years. So I don't know that he's had a really big afterlife, actually. He should. I'm trying.
So in the critique of like the attention economy and our defense of literature as difficult, do you feel like maybe we don't acknowledge Shklovsky, but that he's kind of buried there in that defense, which I still hear from time to time, people, advocating for literature or art as, as an engagement with difficulty. I don't know if there's a precedent before Shklovsky for that, or if he's really the person we kind of should look back to.
I mean, I don't know. I think that it's all very complicated, and I don't know that he's necessarily right. For instance, I was reading Sian Nye's book on the gimmick, and she writes a bit about Shklovsky, but she has a really interesting argument. I'm thinking about she talks about it also in Our Aesthetic Categories, but then sort of continues it in the book on the gimmick. But this idea of the word interesting, as like this word that we apply when we love something, we like something, we call it interesting. And she's like, well, what does interesting mean? Interesting. And she's sort of saying like what interesting kind of means is that we think it's worth our time. We think it's worth revisiting. We think it's worth sort of ruminating on. And she's like, unless I'm misunderstanding, but I think she's kind of saying that this in some ways is kind of an aesthetic judgment, that sort of fits within kind of this capitalist logic of, oh, this is worthwhile and I'm going to, I've decided it's worthwhile by suggesting that it's worth my time. And that there's this way that we kind of value time under capitalism, which really I remember that kind of also sort of threw me a bit, because it's kind of interesting that Shklovsky makes kind of the opposite argument, and he's coming from he wasn't a Bolshevik, but he was definitely, he was part of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. So I think it's complicated. I think that it's, this is one theory of what makes great art. I don't know that it's necessarily, I don't even know that Shklovsky would want to, he wrote this when he was like 24. Wow. I don't know that we should. I don't know. This is like, I don't know. We want to take it that seriously. But to me, it's exciting because it's like a provocative piece, imagine being 24 and be like, no, this is what great art is. And, people reading it 100 years later. I think that's very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that really just adds to your comment earlier about that this is a provocative argument that he's making. This is a provocative essay and it's intentionally that way. Yeah, super interesting.
Which is, I think, really, yeah, I find very freeing to me. I think that's another reason why I suggested it too. Like I don't feel like a lot of space to be experimental, or I don't know. I try my best, but it does feel like we're kind of entering this era where I think, so much of just even kind of like, the criticism that you do, there doesn't feel like a space for kind of purely amateur kind of criticism. Like everything feels so pre-professional. Everyone's just sort of like hoping that the right person will see it and it'll lead to something else. And, I do feel like there's tremendous care or even when someone's being provocative, you know, there's always this suspicion that it's like kind of like provocation for provocation's sake, or I don't know. I think that there's something really exciting about reading criticism at a time when I don't mean to suggest that Shklovsky didn't have literary ambitions, but it really just does feel like a true experiment. I don't feel like he has any agenda. And it's really, exciting to read criticism from, I think, just a different time, a different era, a less market driven kind of, ecosystem for it.
Mm-hmm. So we asked you to select an essay of your own to pair with Art as Device, and you chose The Love Letters That Spoke of Everything But Love. Can you say a bit about this essay and what inspired you to write it?
Yeah, I really loved Zoo. It was just one of these books that really stood out to me when I read it in graduate school. And it was just, one of those books I was always recommending to people. People would sort of go try to find the translation. And they'd be like, you can only buy it for like $1,000 on eBay. I was like, oh crap. And so I was like, all right, I can't keep recommending this. But I really wanted to get the ideas out there because I thought that it was just such a fascinating book and also just an interesting kind of theory of the love letter. Is a great love letter about love? Maybe I should explain a little bit more about Zoo. Basically, it's an epistolary novel, and it's based, there are actual letters between him and a woman named Elsa Triolet, who some people probably know as the French writer who was the first woman to win the Goncourt Prize, and she was a part of the French Resistance and married Louis Aragon, and But anyway, before all that, she was living in Berlin in the 20s, and Victor Shklovsky had a massive crush on her, and just was like bombarding her with all these love letters. And she said, look, you can keep writing me. You just have one rule, which is don't write about love. So he just sort of starts writing about like his everyday life in Berlin, his going to the bakery, all sorts of just kind of like daily life, his thoughts on literature, his thoughts on new writers. And in a way it feels like just tremendously romantic, like in a way that maybe like explicitly writing about love maybe wouldn't be. Like there's just an intimacy, in the kind of, minutia that they share with one another. And it kind of proves, and I feel like in so many ways, like kind of Shklovsky's kind of larger theories about art, that there's something about this kind of defamiliarized love letter that forces you to think about what we actually want from love letters and love language, because it's not what we're expecting from the form. I just thought it was a super interesting book. I wanted more people to know about it and to hear about it. And I was very lucky that my editor then at the Times was interested in an essay on it. It was like around Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. So it, yeah, made sense. And I don't know if this, if it helped convince Dalkey to reissue it or not. I mean, maybe, I don't know, but I'm very glad to hear that more people are going to be able to read it for less than $1,000 on eBay.
Your essay wasn't making, by any means, a kind of reductive biographical reading. But when I was reading it, I felt like I was wondering, did, you know, even though the book Zoo comes out after he writes the essay on defamiliarization, if there was something about Shklovsky's biography that lent itself to him coming up with the theory of estrangement or defamiliarization, that this guy who's being, you know, kind of seems like in some ways not the most charming guy and, you know, puts people off in different ways, if there was a kind of biographical reading that was kind of buried under your essay slightly.
I don't even think I necessarily buried it. I mean, I think that in some ways there's even a double layer of estrangement because who he's really in love with is Russia and he's not able to be there, right? He's living in, you know, he's an emigre in Berlin. Because he wasn't a Bolshevik, he left. You know, there had been show trials. And so a bunch of members of the Socialist Revolutionary Party left. A number of them went to Berlin. There was a big Russian community there. Actually, a friend of mine just wrote a book on it called Charlottengrad, which is because they used to call the neighborhood of Charlottenburg Charlottengrad because so many Russians lived there. And actually, the word zoo, it's because in Berlin, the Tiergarten, the zoo, like, so it was like where all the Russians lived. So even though it's like about Elsa and about his love for her, it's also very much about Russia and how much he misses it. And one of the letters, so there's all these letters between him and Elsa. And then one of the letters is addressed to officials in Russia asking to be let back in. So I think, you know, it's also love, you know, the love letters are all that are themselves kind of it's also a way of kind of defamiliarizing his true love, which is his home country, Russia, which it was, you know, it's been very emotional for me thinking about this in the last, you know, year and a half or so. Like, I have a long-standing relationship with Russia and used to travel there quite frequently. And, you know, I've had to consider, you know, obviously it's not the worst thing in the world that could happen to you compared to what's happening to people there and in Ukraine. But like, I just, there is a sad, I have a sadness now thinking that I might never go back. And so it was just, you know, it's also been just kind of an emotional book to read in that way too.
So we've been talking a lot about defamiliarization for Shklovsky. And can you say a bit about your own relationship to defamiliarization, if you see that as something you're attempting to do through writing?
I don't know. Do I try to? I don't. I mean, you know, in some ways, I think one of the things that's so fun to me about Shklovsky is, you know, he's great. He's got this like science of like literary criticism, and he's got like really strong ideas about what literary criticism is and what it should be. And I find it exciting because I just have none. Like, I'm constantly being asked, you know, I'm always at these panels, you know, being asked like, what is your approach? What is the role of the critic? Like, what are the tasks of criticism? Like, what is your approach? And I'm just like, I have no idea. I just really open up a Word document and I just sort of see what comes out, you know? I mean, like, so for me, it's just kind of like, I'm fascinated by him because I, on some level, I just like, I can't relate to the certainty, that he has. Although I, you know, I tell myself on some level, he also has kind of a sense of humor about certainty too, right? You know, what he says about the Greek columns, like, there's a science to it and yet none of them look the same. So I think that's cool.
There's one line at the very end of your essay that I really loved, where you say that, a quote, that love could best be relayed indirectly became an aesthetic principle for Shklovsky. And then you say at the very end that that the letters not about love end up being a book about love. And when I read that, I was kind of wondering if defamiliarization in a way becomes ultimately about making things familiar in the end, or if that is too, if that doesn't apply in the same way.
Well, I think the thing itself is familiar. I think, you know, everything is familiar. That's the thing. Everything is familiar. Like, I was thinking about War and Peace, and I was like, wow, like, so, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, but that's my life too. My life is just sort of going about my day, worried about, you know, like in so many ways, like Natasha, worried about the person I like, et cetera, while, you know, there are wars being fought. And, you know, and it's the thing, it's like, all things are familiar. And I think that the point of defamiliarization is to maybe nudge you to think maybe it shouldn't be, or maybe I should be sort of processing all of this. Maybe that shouldn't just feel so normal. Maybe it shouldn't just feel like habitual. Maybe it shouldn't feel so automatic and unavoidable. You know, maybe it should feel like something. Maybe we shouldn't be so desensitized to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jen. We really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for bearing with me. I know this was it's a weird essay, so I really appreciate you humoring me.
Thanks everyone for joining us for this episode of Selected Essays. We'd like to thank John Travascus for editing the podcast and Meg Duffy of Hand Habits for contributing the original music. As always, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and please subscribe to The Point. There's a discount code for listeners in the show notes. If you have questions, comments, or anything else, send an email to selectedessays@thepointmag.com. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, listeners.